And, if I never saw him, why was I so sure the intruder was a man? Because, jackass, what woman goes around breaking into houses, charging at doors trying to bust them open with brute strength? For fuck's sake. I never swear, but come on. At some point during this inquisition, my father arrived, followed in short order by Martin and then Tony. We Cashins believe in traveling in packs. Martin and Dad wore jeans. Tony was incongruous in a pinstriped dark suit and tie. I gathered this was so he could head straight to his office afterward, but the effect was imposing, as though he were ready to indict the Prowler on multiple charges right then and there. "So let's walk through this one more time." The detective was tapping his notes with the tip of his ballpoint. "You were asleep. Your burglar alarm never sounded because you had it switched off." "Sis, for Christ's sake," muttered Tony, shooting me a how-dumb-can-you-get look. "Not the moment, Tony." Martin laid a supportive hand on my shoulder. "Burglar alarm wouldn't stop somebody determined, anyway." The detective twitched his rodent nose at me. "But what makes you think it was? What makes you think this was more than a run-of-the-mill burglary? I mean, I get that it was scary, being home alone and a woman and everything. But what makes you think he, let's say it was a he, that he wanted to hurt you?"
Was this guy an idiot? "He ran at the door."
My words punched out like angry fists.
"Did you not see my bedroom door?"
The wood had been splintered around the lock. One of the hinges had been ripped loose from the frame. The sight had made my stomach heave. I had had to turn away.
"Sure, I saw. Somebody tried to bust it open, all right. Probably looking for your jewelry box."
"Oh, please. Last night was not about someone looking for gold brooches."
"Well, now you keep saying that, and I'm just saying, what's the evidence? He smashed the window downstairs to reach in and flip your basement deadlock, and he bashed the lock on that cabinet there, where it looks like you keep your booze."
The detective pointed at a mirrored cabinet in the corner of the living room, where I did indeed store liquor, and where the lock had indeed been bashed in.
"We don't appear to be dealing with a master lockpicker here. We appear to be dealing with an unskilled guy who was in a hurry. He wanted your jewelry, and he wasn't opposed to breaking a few things to get in, get out, get the job done."
"No. For starters, no normal burglar would charge the homeowner."
"Burglar off his head on crack would. Trust me, people on crack do crazy shit."
He caught himself.
"Crazy stuff."
I scowled.
"Look, I can't rule anything out. We'll investigate every possibility, but it might actually put your mind at ease to know there were two other burglaries reported in the neighborhood this week, both here on the west side of Wisconsin Avenue, both involving forced entry at the back or basement door. Windows broken. You see where I'm going? Same guy on a roll. He wasn't after you."
Martin looked at me. "Should you mention that?" He touched his neck. Martin was the only member of my family who knew that an Atlanta police officer had questioned me about the bullet. "Think it might be relevant?" I steeled myself. "Yeah, I did." I had been dancing around this point, trying to avoid staring it in the eye. The idea that events of 34 years ago, however terrifying, had some bearing on my present safety seemed, frankly, ridiculous. I might never know for certain what motive someone had had, all those years ago, to turn a gun on Boone and Sadie Rawson. But whatever it was, I appeared to have been an accidental victim. Collateral damage. The killer hadn't bothered to finish me off then, when it would have been easy. He had not considered me a threat. And then he'd gotten away with murder for more than 30 years. Why come after me now?
Anyone who'd read a newspaper in the last week understood that I remembered nothing. Could identify no one. I know, the bullet. But Beamer Beasley had implied that it wouldn't be of great use to investigators without some sample to match it against. And Beasley himself hadn't seemed terribly concerned about my safety. So yes, I grasped that the bullet posed a threat. But surely the most urgent threat it posed to my health and well-being was the damage it was currently wreaking inside my body. And yet, the D.C. homicide detective's face betrayed both irritation, I was ruining his burglar-on-a-roll theory, and grudging interest as I laid out the events of the last 2 weeks. My family's facial expressions would more accurately be described as appalled. "Let me get this straight," said Martin. "The Atlanta police are reopening a murder case because of evidence inside your neck?" "They want to interview me," I agreed. "Old case, new physical evidence."
"Jesus friggin' Christ," roared Tony. "This is the crazy stuff you were hinting at? You're at the center of an active homicide investigation? You didn't think that was worth outright mentioning?"
"Tony," my dad warned.
"And as for these Georgia police bozos," Tony roared on. "Who's running things down there? Sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane? Has it not occurred to them that someone else might be interested in the new evidence? Someone with a personal stake in making sure that bullet never finds its way into police hands? Did it not occur—"
"Stop it. Just stop it. The police officer I met with in Atlanta is a good guy, not a bozo. His name's Beasley. He was on the original team that investigated back in 79.
"Well, that's a ringing endorsement," snorted Tony, "although I might be more impressed if they'd, say, solved the murders or caught the guy."
I ignored this. I didn't say anything because I didn't want to hype this into a bigger deal than it is. When they reopen an investigation, all it means is that a couple of people get assigned to comb over old files. There's a cold case squad, that's what it's actually called, that takes a look if fresh evidence comes to light. They've cautioned me not to expect much. And anyway, I added, clinging to what Beasley had said, whoever killed my birth parents may well be dead himself after all these years.
"Unless he's not," muttered Tony.
My dad and Martin nodded in apparent agreement. I turned to where the D.C. detective sat perched on my sofa, looking a bit stunned. "Atlanta police will verify everything I've just told you. It's been all over the newspaper down there." He sighed, as if this were the worst news yet.
"You got a number for this Beasley that you can give me? I'll check it out."
"You do that," snapped Tony. "And when you're done, you can turn your attention to sorting out some police protection for my sister, as should have been done several days ago, which, if it had been done, might have prevented her from being scared shitless last night. Meanwhile," he swiveled back to me, "meanwhile, I'm taking you to buy a gun."
"Tony, will you stop being so dramatic?"
"I'm not being dramatic. I'm being practical."
We sat glaring at each other. Martin flicked his gaze back and forth between us. A good 30 seconds passed. Then, under his breath, he muttered,
"Nice Roscoe Coltrane reference."
"Butt out," Tony growled.
"Sure. Seriously, though. Skillfully done."
Martin leaned back, drummed his fingers on a side table, whistling softly. I hadn't heard the tune in a long time. Good old boys. It took another half minute, but Tony cracked. A smile began to play around his lips.
"Enos,"
he whispered in what sounded like an outrageous southern accent.
"Enos."
Martin's shoulders began to shake. Tony, warming up now.
"This is your superior officer, Sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane."
Dad studied his sons in bewilderment.
"What the hell are they talking about?"
"The Dukes of Hazzard," I ventured. that TV show they used to love? Wasn't Roscoe the sidekick to, what's his name? Boss Hogg?
Breaker one, breaker one, Martin drawled. I may be crazy, but I ain't dumb.
I giggled. I couldn't help it. Even Dad started to smile. The detective looked as if he wanted to flee. I had never loved my brother so much in my life. 30. A decision was made that I should pack a bag and sleep at my parents' house tonight. I didn't resist. No way was I sleeping alone behind that broken bedroom door. My parents had a burglar alarm with motion detectors, and the beagle barked if a leaf so much as rustled in the yard. I would be safe. Dad waited while I threw a toothbrush, makeup, and a change of clothes in a bag, then drove me up to Cleveland Park. Mom was standing on the front step. She folded me in her arms, kissed my hair, whispering over and over, "Sweet baby girl." She insisted that I follow her into the kitchen and take some soup. It was only 9 in the morning, but I submitted. Hot lentil with lamb and cinnamon. Delicious. I excused myself and climbed to my old room on the top floor. I stripped and stood beneath a scalding shower until my skin bloomed pink and my fingertips shriveled white and wrinkly. The ache in my wrist eased a little. The adrenaline that had carried me these last several hours was depleted. I needed sleep. Before I drew the curtains, I pulled out my phone and dialed Will. It went straight to voicemail. He might be with a patient, I mused. Or he might still be angry from our argument last night. Or punishing me for never answering my own phone. The phone beeped, indicating it was recording. Hi, call me. I couldn't think what else to say. Couldn't think where to begin an accounting of what had happened in the hours since we'd parted. I fanned my still dripping hair across the pillow, drew up the covers, and sank into a dreamless sleep. When I woke, the clock read 4 o'clock. My phone showed 3 messages. The first was from Madame Aubuchon, a stiffly formal message inquiring as to my health and adding that she had changed her mind. She wanted her soup pot back. Next came messages from Beasley and from the surgeon Marshall Gellert. These were both short, stating only their names and asking me to call back at my earliest convenience. I called Beasley first. Washington Metropolitan Police had already been in touch and filled him in on last night's drama, but he made me retell what had happened, in painful detail.
"I surely am sorry you had to go through that," he said after I finished. "You're the last person on earth I would wish it on. And I'm sorry to make you relive it again right now, but I needed to hear the details firsthand from you. Make sure nothing important got left out."
"Of course."
"I don't know. I'm being honest with you. I don't know whether what happened last night has anything to do with what happened back in 79. But say somebody does want to get his hands on that bullet. Coming after you when you were home alone at night would make sense."
I shivered.
"Tonight you're staying with your parents, correct? They'll be with you the whole time. You're not going out."
I glanced at my reflection in the mirror on the bedroom wall. My hair had dried in a weird cowlick while I slept. My eyes were ringed by dark circles, and I was wearing saggy sweatpants and a Duke basketball t-shirt filched from an ex-boyfriend. If you could see me, you'd know I'm not fit to be seen in public.
"Good. If they haven't been already, local police will be in touch. They're arranging a cruiser to drive by your house throughout the night. But they can't watch you every second, so it's best if you stay inside and keep people around you."
"You really think I'm in danger, then?"
I think I would never forgive myself if anything else were to happen to you.
Beasley was quiet for a moment.
In better news, I can tell you that last night has lit a fire under people here. I've been pushing all week for your family's files, kept getting told they couldn't find them. Then, lunchtime today, not 3 hours after Washington MPD got on the horn asking about you, 2 big fat boxes appear on my desk. They must have finally sent somebody with a brain out to off-site storage.
What's in the boxes?
Stuff. I'm going through it. That's about all I can say at the moment.
Because you're not allowed to say, or because you need time to... Beasley acted as if he hadn't heard me.
Your formal interview. I'd prefer to do it in person, but in the interest of time, let me see if I can schedule a slot in one of Washington MPD's interview rooms. We'll send a car for you.
Can't we just do it by phone?
No, we need it videotaped. Let's aim for first thing tomorrow.
I chewed my lip, weighed what to say next, decided what the hell. My brother wants to buy me a gun for self-defense.
You know how to shoot?
No. I didn't add that I'd never handled a firearm in my life. I'd have to get some instruction.
Beasley made a doubtful noise. You're talking a handgun, I assume. Takes a while to get comfortable with one. Feel like you know what you're doing. My advice, my official advice, would be to leave the guns to the cops. Local police will do fine looking out for your security.
You said that's your official advice. What about unofficially? He hesitated, then sighed.
Off the record, speaking as a father, I'd say something small, maybe a 9mm baby Glock. Might not be a terrible idea.
I hear you're agitating to move up the surgery by a few days.
Am I? Where did you hear that?
Marshall Gellert and I had played phone tag the better part of the afternoon. He finally caught me as I was setting my mother's table for dinner.
Oh,
he said, taken aback. I got a call at lunchtime from a police detective down in Georgia, saying that the bullet in your neck is relevant to an investigation and that they want to examine it sooner rather than later. He wouldn't give me details, but I assume that isn't news to you. I thought you must know he was calling.
I didn't, but I'd welcome getting the surgery over with. So Beamer Beasley wasn't messing around. When, then?
I'm closing in on next Monday, instead of next Wednesday. Would that fit your schedule?
What schedule? My current schedule consisted of hiding out at my parents' house, being force-fed lamb and lentil soup, and being ignored by my boyfriend, if that was what you could call Will Zartman.
As it happens, Gellert continued, bumping it up is preferable from a medical point of view as well. Every day might be critical if the foreign object, meaning the bullet, really is shifting. Monday's the earliest I can get the hospital facilities booked at Sibley. And the cameraman is on board for then, too.
Did you say the cameraman? Gellert
had the decency to sound embarrassed. I did explain already. It's quite unusual that someone with your specific injury would survive, nay, thrive into adulthood. A few of my peers started blogging about you last week when the Journal Constitution article went live. You haven't seen the posts?
No, I had not.
Everyone's hoping you'll consent to having the operation filmed for teaching purposes. You're something of a celebrity in neurology circles.
I'm something of a celebrity in neurology circles. Into my head popped an unpleasant image. A circle of erasable pen-wielding geeks, thick spectacles sliding down slickly pimpled noses, salivating to watch my neck being sliced open.
For what it's worth, Dr. Zartman is in agreement. Both that we should film the surgery and that we should proceed as soon as possible.
My breath caught. When did you speak with Dr. Zartman?
This morning. We conferred before I called you.
So, Will was alive and well, and conferring about my surgical options. Just not taking my calls.
I'll have my nurse follow up with you. She can explain the pre-op protocol. In a nutshell, we can give you Vicodin if you're in pain, but no food, no Advil or other anti-inflammatories after 6 p.m. on Sunday. I'm writing you a prescription right now.
Thanks. And, did you ever find my chart? Did they find that guy who broke in?
Negative. Don't worry, we've reconstructed your chart. Everything's in order. And I can't figure out what that intruder business was all about. Guy didn't seem to take a damn thing.
For several minutes after we hung up, I sat still, imagining those impossibly blue eyes boring down on the clean white prescription pad. Then his hands, the hyperactive fingers, darting across the paper, twirling, weaving like spiders. A lot about my present circumstances frightened me. But for some reason, I felt safe in those hands. 31. Friday, October 25th, 2013. Calling me the worst shot ever to pull a trigger at the Chantilly rifle and revolver range is an exaggeration, but I was probably the worst shot they'd seen in a very long time. The gun range was half an hour's drive straight west. You took the Key Bridge across the Potomac River into northern Virginia, got on I-66 and kept going. The building was ugly. Its low-slung yellow stucco facade set across a busy road from a strip mall. Plastic letters stuck to the glass doors spelled out, "Open to the public," and "No loaded guns." Inside it was clean and quiet. Guns of every shape and size were laid out in glass display cases. On the walls hung framed posters. One showed a middle-aged man aiming a pistol at the camera, beneath an invitation, "Stop by for a few shots after work. Bring your friends along for a different kind of happy hour." Or my personal favorite, "Anger management issues? Relationship problems? Try our therapeutic solution." This was accompanied by a photo of a woman firing at a human silhouette. She had ignored the red target marked on the chest, but 15 bullet holes were pierced clean through the crotch. Learning to shoot was surprisingly cheap. $10 per person, per lane, per hour. Paper targets cost $1. Same again to rent the mandatory ear and eye protection. You could try out as many handguns as you wanted for $10. Hell, you could rent an AK-47 for $19 for the entire day. Tony marched up to the counter, explained that I was a beginner and that I wanted to learn to use a handgun. "Never handled firearms before?" asked the woman. A name tag identified her as Irene. Her skin was bad and her black hair hung in an unflattering bowl cut. But from what I could see of her jeans behind the counter, she had a fantastic figure. "Never," I confirmed.
"You looking for a revolver or a semi-automatic?"
"What's the difference?"
She and Tony exchanged glances. "Why don't you try them both out? See what you like. Personally, I love me a revolver. Just as accurate, won't jam on you."
She took out a gun, spun it open to demonstrate it wasn't loaded, laid it on the counter.
"Is this for carrying in your purse or keeping in your nightstand? Picking the right gun's all about trade-offs."
I glanced down at my purse, a black Chanel clutch that I'd bought in Paris years ago. It had taken months to pay it off on my credit card, and it was barely big enough to fit my car keys and a lipstick.
"Nightstand, I guess. So you could go with a bigger gun, less kickback.
Wouldn't a bigger gun have more kickback?
I knew you'd ask that, she smiled sweetly. Beginners always do. But think about it. You fire the same bullet from a big gun and a small one, the bigger one's going to absorb more of the recoil. Basic physics. Let me get you two set up. I'm not busy. It's quiet as a church in here today.
Irene strung a target halfway down the firing range. She showed me how to hold a gun, how to load it, how to aim. Easy. The target had a blue bullseye and a helpful shooter tutor. If your shots were going wide to the left, it told you to adjust your trigger finger. If they all went low, you were anticipating recoil, and so on. But the only thing consistent about my performance was that every shot missed, by a mile. After my first 10 attempts, Irene reeled in the target to a mere 5 yards away.
Doesn't need to be too far, don't worry. Let's be real. You want a gun for personal protection. You're not going to be shooting the guy from 25 yards, are you?
The trouble may have been my utter lack of athletic ability. I don't deny it. I had demonstrated lamentable hand-eye coordination convincingly and humiliatingly in year after year of childhood sports events. But you try shooting left-handed when you're not. My dominant right hand dangled in its brace. At the start, I had tried to wrap it around my left for stability, but the kickback hurt too much, no matter which model gun we tried. After half an hour, all three of us could tell it was a lost cause. I paid and tipped Irene. She handed over my shooter tutor as a souvenir. In the parking lot, I crumpled it into a ball.
Well, that was embarrassing. You did fine, Tony said. It's my fault. I should have taken into account how hard it would be to shoot with one arm in a brace.
You looked ready to disown me as your sister in there.
Only when you were asking genuinely idiotic questions, like whether there's a difference between a revolver and a semi-automatic.
Well, is there?
For Christ's sake.
If it makes you feel any better, I said nastily, you can disown me anytime you like, since we're not actually related.
He spun around. His face was purple. Don't say that again, ever.
I jerked open the car door, threw myself inside, and slammed it shut. He stood frozen in the parking lot, watching me through the window the way you would watch a rabid possum. We drove home in silence, Tony at the wheel, staring grimly out the windshield. As we crossed the Key Bridge into Georgetown, I stretched my left hand to rest on his shoulder. He did not swat it away. That's as close to saying sorry as Tony and I tended to get. At lunchtime, Beamer Beasley telephoned. Again. I was surprised to hear from him so soon. The formal interview had gone fine this morning. An unmarked police car had delivered me to and from the session. Both Beasley and Jerry Fleeman, the head of the cold case squad, were on the video link up asking questions. I'd thought I'd answered them satisfactorily. But apparently, not until afterward did Beasley finish digging through the boxes. He had found evidence bullets. Several. Fired from 2 different guns. They would have something to compare my bullet with, after all.
I thought you didn't have sample bullets, I said, shocked. The one that hit Boone, I thought the killer gouged it out of the doorframe.
These aren't from your crime scene. These are bullets collected as a precaution, for the purpose of comparison.
I don't follow.
Easiest way to match a bullet isn't against the gun that fired it, it's against another bullet. You compare like to like. You know what rifling is? It's the spiral grooves on the inside of a gun barrel. Every rifle, every handgun has rifling almost as unique as a fingerprint. even ones made in the same batch in the same factory. And the differences get more pronounced over time as the gun gets cleaned and fired. So when you fire a gun, it leaves its signature on the projectile. We're talking tiny markings, microscopic, but a good lab tech can spot them. With homicide cases, you always fire sample shots from a weapon recovered from a crime scene.
I was still struggling to follow this. The point remains that you didn't find a gun in my parents' house, or a bullet.
True. We did have suspects, though. Remember, I told you about three separate men who we brought in for questioning, for one reason or another. Two of them owned guns. Nothing illegal about that. We didn't have cause to seize the firearms, but we did fire test bullets from them into ballistic gelatin, just in case. Just in case another bullet ever came along to match.
I sucked in my breath. You've been hoping all this time to get your hands on the bullet in my neck.
That's an ugly way of putting it.
But why didn't you tell me about the other bullets before?
I didn't know. I've worked homicide on and off for 40 years. We're talking hundreds, maybe 1,000 murders. Not making excuses, but that's a lot of evidence to keep straight in your head. And like I told you, back in 79, we were getting slammed by a new murder nearly every day here in Atlanta.
Beasley swallowed.
I was praying we had the sense to collect evidence bullets during your mama and daddy's investigation, but I wasn't sure. Couldn't remember. Nothing in the paperwork that I had kept indicated one way or the other.
I sighed. I suppose it's a miracle they weren't thrown away, that you were able to lay hands on them after so much time.
If you could see what passes for a filing system down here, you'd know that's the truth.
He harumphed.
Meanwhile, I gather your operation's been bumped up to Monday.
Yes. And I really wish you hadn't hassled my surgeon without checking with me first.
Ms. Cashin, it's my job to collect the evidence and to do what I can to protect you. Trust me, it's in your interest to hurry up and get that bullet out. If I had my way, they'd be wheeling you into the O.R. this very minute.
32. Beasley's news shook me. Perhaps the most frustrating aspect was that I could do nothing but wait. Wait for next week's operation. Wait to see if I ended up paralyzed. Wait to see if the bullet proved useful. I paced my bedroom, picked up a book, tried to concentrate, snapped it shut after I found myself reading the same paragraph on Jean-Paul Sartre a fourth time. I resumed pacing, feeling frightened, furious, and at loose ends, all at once, proved a dangerous combination. By 6 that evening, I gave in to temptation. Will's cell did not answer, and his work phone went straight to an answering service. His house, then. It surprised me to realize I had only a vague notion where he lived. Helpfully, Zartman is an unusual name. The white pages online listed a phone number and a home address. Lorcom Lane in Arlington, Virginia, just across the river. I could hardly drive myself there. Not after the burglary. Not after what Beasley had told me. I was a prisoner in my childhood home. I sat pondering the problem. Then I called Martin and told him I needed to see someone, that we were headed to Arlington, and that he would have to wait in the car. He picked me up an hour later.
Let me guess. You're Dr. Sprockets.
Martin smirked. I shot him an annoyed glance, said nothing.
Tony said he's a great guy. Why don't you just invite him up to the house?
Are you hiding him from Mom and Dad for some reason?
As it happens, he's not returning my calls.
My brother cocked his head sideways. I hate to break this to you, but generally speaking, that's a sign that a guy isn't interested.
Thank you for that deep insight into the male mind, I retorted. I know what it usually means. But I'm hoping he's avoiding me because he's trying to do the honorable thing. I explained about doctor-patient relationships being verboten, about Will's squirming and then storming out the other night.
You could switch doctors, Martin said.
That's what I told him. It was quiet on Lorcombe Lane. The streetlights had switched on to illuminate 2- and 3-story brick colonials, well-kept, typical American suburbia. I felt uneasy. I had imagined Will living in a condo, maybe a converted loft, all exposed brick and soaring ceilings. When we reached the right address, Martin swung the car into the driveway. His headlights picked out Will's Jeep. A basketball hoop hung suspended above the garage. Below it, a child's bike lay on its side. All of a sudden, I understood. You wanted a scene. You wanted to read about me bursting into tears, about the cliched confrontation with the pretty wife who answers the door, about who slapped whom first. I'm not that girl. I told you already. I'm not prone to outbursts, not a volatile person. Martin, on the other hand, was outraged. He trained his brights on the child's bike, trying to make sense of what this object could be doing in my boyfriend's driveway. He took a second or two longer than I had to figure out that Will must be married, that he was a father.
Do you want me to kneecap him? Martin asked. Spell out dickwad on his lawn?
Just turn around, hurry up, before someone comes out of the house and sees us. We drove home in silence, me staring out the window, clutching my right wrist, wishing I'd let Tony buy me that 9mm baby Glock after all. Martin walked me up to our parents' front steps and onto the porch, muttering, "He's a dickwad whether we trash his front lawn or not. You are so out of his league. Christ, do I want to call Tony and invite this guy to join us for a friendly beer, give him a little education on how to treat our sister.
Thank you, but I'm fine."
I was turning my cheek for him to kiss me goodnight when I saw it. The gray car, parked just as before, across the street and a few spaces down. How could such a nondescript car be so noticeable? "Martin," I whispered, "do you see that car?"
An education that would leave him unable to walk for the next week.
My brother was still muttering. "Martin, that gray car, do you see it?" He turned, shaded his eyes against the porch light.
"What about it?"
"It was parked outside my house on Q Street the other night. The same car."
"Are you sure?"
"No, I wasn't sure. It was your run-of-the-mill gray compact car, utterly unremarkable. But either I was going crazy or I had seen this car before." And I went with the latter.
I think so.
There was a man inside." My brother scowled, squinted across the street again, started loping down across the lawn.
"Martin," I hissed, "stop!"
The car's ignition started up. The headlights blinked on, and suddenly it was reversing. It knocked into the bumper of the car parked behind, then lurched into the street, engine roaring, tires squealing.
"Get inside," said my brother.
I stood frozen, glued to the porch.
"Sis, get inside!"
I didn't wait for him to tell me a third time. 33. Saturday, October 26th, 2013. Dr. Gellert commenced operating at 11:07 a.m. He was assisted, I was later told, by the on-duty anesthesiologist, two nurses, and three residents who had had their plans for a lazy weekend morning rudely interrupted by urgent summonses from the hospital. The procedure was not filmed. No cameraman could be located on such short notice. The gray car had achieved what Beasley had wished for but had not been able to achieve: instant surgery. Last night, within minutes of my phone call to 911, three police cars had swarmed the street in front of my parents' home. Sirens wailed to wake the dead. Blue lights blazed. Cops muscled their way through the front door. Phone calls had been exchanged with Atlanta, most of which I was not privy to, other than one short exchange with Beasley, during which, as usual, he made me walk him step by step through what I had seen. The result of all this midnight conferencing had been that Mom and Dad, white with worry, drove me to Sibley Hospital's emergency room. A police car, sirens mercifully silenced, but blue lights flashing in full glory, had led the way. We arrived before dawn. I was transferred from the car to a wheelchair and then to a gurney. A plastic bracelet was strung around my good wrist. More phone calls were made. My clothes were removed and replaced by a paper surgery gown. A somber, whiskery anesthesiologist appeared, introduced himself, explained his plans to make me comfortable. I forgot his name before he even left the room. Drugs, I was thinking. Please just give me the drugs. Give me everything you've got. During the long, long night we had just endured, pain had seized my neck and my shoulders, pain so severe it had felt my body would break in two. This was not the sharp pulsing I had grown used to. This was more dense, heavy, like an apron of lead, the kind they swaddle you in before taking an X-ray. Smiling nurses appeared. Guardrails on the sides of the gurney swung up and locked into place. The gurney began to roll. A mask came down over my face. "Breathe deep," said the smiles. My mother was walking beside me, still holding my hand. Darkness. I came to in a post-surgery recovery room. Cold. I was so cold. I had never been so cold. My legs would have to be amputated. They would not survive. The frostbite was turning my skin to wax. I sensed someone beside me. "Blanket," I tried to tell them. It came out mush. "Blanchot." The person leaned down. "Caroline?" Will's voice. Soft. Worried. He laid a hand on top of mine. "No." I wanted to turn my head away. It would not obey. "Blanket," I said again. He would not listen.
"Caroline, it's me. Everything went fine. You're going to be fine."
Something scratchy was wrapped around my neck, the only part of me that was warm. I willed myself to go under again, to sleep. 34. Sunday, October 27th, 2013. They only kept me in the hospital for one night. The surgery had gone beautifully. The bullet had popped. Dr. Gellert pursed his lips and made a loud pop as he recounted this to me. Popped right out.
"Like squeezing a boiled tomato from its skin," he added, clearly pleased with himself. "Big ol' thing. Half an inch long."
He held up his thumb and forefinger in approximation. "Where is it?"
"I cleaned it up, sealed it in a sterile envelope, handed it to the police myself."
His fingers were sliding up and down a Perspex clipboard,
rising and then striking the edge as if it were the keys of a baby grand. They rushed the bullet straight to the lab. It was an Atlanta cop who turned up to get it. Flew up here specifically for that purpose. Warned me not to let D.C. police anywhere near it. Gellert eyed me with curiosity, but did not ask.
I nodded.
Tried to nod. The bandages made it impossible to move. At any rate, the headline is, we got it out. You did great. The incision on the back of your neck is less than 2 inches wide. You'll have a scar, but it'll fade and your hair will cover it.
I don't care about that. What about my spinal cord?
Will I have full range of movement? At the moment, I felt no pain at all, but I was pumped so full of painkillers that it was hard to say whether that meant much. We'll have to wait until the swelling subsides, and it will take time for everything internally to knit back together. But so far, so good. I'll see you tomorrow in my regular office to check the stitches and make sure everything's draining properly. At my parents' house, they had made up a bed in the living room so I wouldn't have to climb the stairs. All afternoon, I dozed. Dad sat vigil in an armchair by the window, answering emails and cursing at the New York Times crossword puzzle. Hunt lay flopped across his feet. Mom wandered in and out, inventing ways to make herself useful. I was hungry, starving. I had been forbidden from consuming anything except liquids until I either produced a bowel movement or passed gas. I achieved this milestone, the latter, as twilight fell. I felt undignified, to say the least. But I was rewarded with crackers and a cup of Mom's homemade beef noodle soup. 35. Monday, October 28th, 2013. My neck felt better. That's the only way to describe it. Just as simply as that. My parents' living room had no curtains. The house was set well back from the street, and I woke early with the light. I was stiff from the lumpy makeshift bed. My bandages itched. But I had slept unexpectedly well. I wiggled my toes, clenched and unclenched my buttocks, shifted my hips. Then, cautiously, I tested my shoulders. They were sore but loose. Finally, I shut my eyes, held my breath, and flexed my right wrist. I had not taken Vicodin since dinner last night, 12 hours ago. I felt no pain. Will Zartman had left 5 phone messages in the 30 hours since I'd left the hospital. I wish I could tell you that I found the willpower to delete them without listening, but I did not. Not that they said much. Call me. Would you please call me? Each new message sounded less hopeful than the last. When the phone buzzed again in the late afternoon, I screwed up my courage and answered. Hello, Will.
Caroline, I've left you 6 messages.
5, actually.
Right. I gather you're back to never answering your phone.
He sounded uncertain, trying to gauge how mad I was.
That's right. I guess 2 can play that game. Pretty damn mad, you cowardly lying turd.
He cleared his throat.
Marshall said the surgery went very well. How are you feeling?
Oh, just dandy.
A moment passed.
Look, I know I owe you an apology. Make that 7 apologies. I heard about the break-in at your house. I feel awful. I shouldn't have left you. I'm so sorry.
I drove by your house, Will.
My house? When?
There was no mistaking the terror in his voice.
Don't worry. I didn't ring the doorbell.
Pause.
So, how many children do you have?
Long pause.
too.
We didn't have much to say to each other after that. 36. Tuesday, October 29th, 2013. By Tuesday, I was up and walking around. For the first time in days, I got dressed. My jeans hung loose on my hips. My belly was taut and flat. Major surgery and an all-liquid diet were apparently good for 5 pounds. At breakfast, I peeled 3 kiwis and ate them with a soft-boiled egg. As I chewed, I practiced turning my head to the right to look out the kitchen window onto the magnolia tree that dominates the front yard, then left in the direction of the stove and sink. Right and left, back and forth. Dr. Gellert had removed the bulkiest bandages yesterday. All that remained was a thin gauze pad, held in place with flesh-colored first aid tape. The tape pulled at the hairs on the back of my neck. Otherwise, I felt no discomfort. I checked my email. A message from Georgetown University Police alerted students and faculty to a reported theft on the ground floor of Lowinger, the undergraduate library. We were reminded not to leave laptops or other personal items unattended on campus. I wondered whether Al had been on duty. Lowinger sat on the main quad, not 100 yards from his stone police hut. It occurred to me that I needed to return his jackets. There was also a brief message from Beasley. The bullet had arrived safely back in Atlanta over the weekend. Lab technicians were working on it. He would keep me posted. As I cleared my dishes, I caught sight of my reflection in the glass door of the microwave oven. I looked nothing like myself. My face was thin, my skin was pale, and my hair had seen better days. When had I last washed it? Friday? I was not supposed to get the stitches wet, not yet, but I was allowed to wash from the chest down. It would be better than nothing. In the bathroom, I dropped my clothes on the floor and peeled back the gauze pad. Gingerly, I raised my hand to touch the back of my neck. The stitches were raised, lumpy knots beneath my fingertips. They would dissolve on their own as the incision healed. The skin on my neck, meanwhile, was numb. I could not feel my fingers pressing down. Dr. Gellert had told me the area might stay numb for weeks, or it might stay numb forever. I wondered about the arteries in my neck, the muscles, whether they were shifting by fractions of an inch, filling in the space where the bullet had been. After a minute, I sat down on the edge of the bathtub, loosened the straps holding on my wrist brace, and took it off. My right forearm was visibly thinner than my left. The muscles, never impressive to begin with, had shrunk over months of disuse. I picked up the brace, refastened the straps, folded it in half lengthways, and tucked it in the cabinet beneath the sink. I had the feeling I would not be needing it again. 37. Wednesday, October 30th, 2013. My house on Q Street smelled heavenly. I moved back to my own home 4 days after the operation. By then, it was obvious to everyone, even my mother, that I was perfectly capable of caring for myself. In my absence, Martin's wife, Laura, had let herself in and scoured the place with Windex and Pledge. The table in my kitchen gleamed. She had vacuumed the carpets, scrubbed the windows, even laundered the sheets and made up my bed. The heavenly scent floated up from vases of flowers that she had arranged in every room. Peonies, the dark pink ones, my favorites. Where on earth had Laura found them in October? I resolved to be nicer to my sister-in-law. I would owe her some serious babysitting time for this.
Dad had also been busy. He had hired a locksmith to install new deadbolts on all the doors, and a glazier to fix the basement window. My bedroom door he had replaced himself, adding a sturdy lock that could be opened only from the inside. He presented me with a new ring of keys and two spare sets, adding that he would be back in the morning, both to look in on me and to meet the electrician. The electrician?
Thought it might be wise to put in floodlights at your front door and around the back of the house. I ordered the motion-sensitive kind. Anybody steps within a few feet of the house, it'll trigger them.
He looked so worried that I put my arms around his waist and kissed him. Dad, I'll be fine now.
Call before you go to bed tonight. Let us know you're all right.
Promise.
And set your burglar alarm.
I gave a sharp, rueful laugh. Don't worry. After he left, I made another tour of my house, checking every lock, turning on every light. All was in order. There was no trace of last week's nightmarish events. The doorbell rang as I was climbing up to my bedroom to unpack. I froze, crept back down the stairs and tiptoed to the front door. Through the peephole, I could see only the bald top of a man's head. He was holding something large and shimmery. I couldn't make out what it was. Ding dong, ding dong. Who is it? I called, my voice squeaking with fear, not sure if I could be heard through the locked door.
FTD, delivery.
Just leave it on the step.
Need your signature, ma'am.
I coughed loudly. I'm sick. Cough. Contagious. And, I don't want the Dobermans to get out. In addition to my father's security precautions, I was going to go online tonight and order a bunch of those Beware of Guard Dog stickers to slap on every window. I thought I heard the man sigh. He bent down, and then my peephole view was blocked by the shimmery blob. What was that? From the curb came the sound of a car engine starting and pulling away. I waited several seconds, then sneaked into the living room and peeked out the window. No one was on the front step or anywhere in sight. I yanked the door open to find a huge bouquet of silver balloons, weighted down by a basket stuffed with chocolate. Inside the basket was a note.
For sweet Caroline, get well soon, and then come see us. Your devoted admirer, Leland Brett.
I was smiling and carrying the balloons into the living room when I noticed a bag tucked in the corner of the hall. A paper shopping bag, the kind with handles, half filled with mail. Laura must have tidied up everything the postman had pushed through the letter slot this past week. I dumped the contents on the coffee table. 4 catalogs from Pottery Barn, a store where I had never shopped. A coupon for a free entree on my birthday from Mai Tai, the neighborhood Thai restaurant. Bills from Washington Gas and AT&T. And a thick manila envelope, postmarked Atlanta and mailed 5 days ago. I ripped it open. Inside was a handwritten note from Cheryl Rooney. Dear Caroline, I am writing and hoping this finds you well. I expect you saw my quote in the newspaper about how much you and SR look alike. I enclosed the article in case you missed it. I was embarrassed to be interviewed, to tell the truth. My mother always said a lady should only appear in the newspaper 3 times— when she's born, when she marries, and when she dies. Times change, though. You asked to see a photo. You said you deserve to know the truth, even the bad parts. I went back and forth on whether to send these to you. Then I decided you are right. Sincerely, Cheryl. P.S. Your mother loved you very much. Don't you ever forget it. From the envelope, I shook a crumpled newspaper clipping and several faded photos. These, small and square, had a wide white border, the way photographs were printed when I was a child. I picked up the first one and studied it. Blinked. Standing there, with his arm around Sadie Rossen Smith, was a man I recognized. 38. I had to squint. I'd only met him the one time. Ethan Sinclair looked young in the photo, but his features were unmistakable. The second picture showed Sadie Rossen and a young Cheryl posing in profile with matching pregnancy bumps. The third was the original of Boone and Sadie Rossen flipping burgers at a backyard barbecue, the one that ran in the Journal Constitution in 1979, the one that had brought tears to my eyes 2 weeks ago when Jessica Yao had unearthed it from the archives. It must have been Cheryl who provided it to the newspaper in the first place. The last image was blurry and shot from a strange angle, as though the photographer had not wanted to be detected. It showed Sadie Rossen lounging on the sand in a bikini, reading a magazine, her eyes hidden behind huge sunglasses. A few feet away, a deeply tanned man sat watching her. I couldn't swear to it, but it looked like Sinclair. I fanned out the four photos, the clipping, and Cheryl's note on the table. It didn't make sense. I fetched a glass of water from the kitchen, then sank back onto the sofa. It took a minute to locate Cheryl's phone number.
Hey, honey, I'm glad to hear from you. Did you get my...
You said Sadie Rossen's lover was named Tank.
He was.
But this photo you mailed me... I know this man. His name is Ethan Sinclair.
I know that, honey. I told you Tank was his high school nickname from the football team. It's what we all called him. I don't know whether he still goes by it. I'm happy to say I haven't seen that psychopath in 30 years, but...
She stopped. She seemed to have just processed what I had said.
But, Caroline, did you say you know him?
He came to my hotel in Atlanta the same week I met you. She gasped in horror.
Did he try to hurt you?
No. He was nice. He bought me breakfast. I wouldn't have let him if I'd known, but he picked up the entire bill for my hotel room, 3 nights at the St. Regis. She grunted.
I didn't say he was poor. I said he was a damn psychopath.
Cheryl, you must know that the police checked out Sinclair. It wasn't him. Couldn't have been.
Sure, sure. Why, because there's no proof that he and Sades were having an affair? And because he had an ironclad alibi?
I raised my eyebrows. Those aren't trivial points, Cheryl.
I gave the police that photo of him ogling her on the beach. He was in love with her. It's totally obvious.
If she was talking about the picture I now held in my hand, I was not convinced. All it seemed to prove was that he appreciated